My name is Velocity Child. Every Thursday at the stroke of midnight, step into the parlor of Fallen Woman. A weekly soiree of artists on the fringe with underground thoughts and voices shared with uncensored abandon. Through provocative opinions, seductive humor, candor, and song. You are listening to Fallen Woman on Radio Free Brooklyn. And tonight is a special nighttime story edition. I will be reading stories, nay, fairy tales, from Barbara G. Walker. And we start with The She-Wolf. Once upon a time, there was a poor widower who lived with his daughter, Lupa, in a wretched hut on a stony little farm. The land produced hardly enough food for them, and their only reliable source of nourishment was one cow. One cow who gave milk, butter, and cheese. The widower's only pleasure in life was watching his daughter grow up. She was both clever and kind, the apple of her father's eye. One day disaster struck. The cow took sick and died. There was no more milk, butter, or cheese to be had. The widower had no money to buy another cow, or even a chicken, or two for eggs. He and Lupa cut up the dead cow and preserved her meat, which nourished them for a while. After the meat was gone, they had almost nothing left, but the seeds put by for a new crop. The widower's late wife had been an accomplished needlewoman and had left some beautiful tapestries behind when she died. Lupa's father took them from storage. "I had hoped to keep these in memory of your mother," he told Lupa sadly. "Now I have no other choice but to offer them for sale. Tomorrow, I must start with spring planting. While I do that, you must take this embroidery to the market and get the best price you can." Early the next morning, Lupa set out with the tapestries rolled up under her arm. She had to travel many miles to town along the way, and a fierce thunderstorm came up. Finding no shelter, she trudged on through the rain and became more thoroughly soaked. After the sky cleared, Lupa opened the soggy roll of tapestries to wring them out. To her horror, she found out that all the colors had run together. Her mother had not been able to afford color-fast dyes. The pictures were ruined. Feeling hopeless and frustrated, Lupa sat down beside a road and cried. Not only did she now have nothing to sell, but she had even lost her mother's handiwork, which would grieve her father very much. After a while, she dried her tears and decided to go onto the market anyway, hoping to sell the canvas itself, or perhaps just beg for a few coins or a bit of bread to take home. As she was passing through a thick forest, she heard a dismal howling not far away. It seemed the very expression of her own sorrow. Too depressed to feel frightened, she followed the sound and came upon a gray, yellow-eyed she-wolf caught in a trap by her right foreleg. Howling with pain and distress, "Oh, poor wolf," said kind-hearted Lupa, "can I help you?" To her amazed delight, the wolf replied. "Get me out of this trap," begged the wolf. "I have babies at home in my den. They will die if they lose me." Lupa picked up a stout stick and opened the jaws of the trap to release the wolf's leg. Then she squatted down and tenderly bandaged the lacerated limb with a strip torn from her petticoat. The wolf stood patiently for these ministrations. My cubs and I thank you, she said. How can I repay your kindness? Alas, my situation is so unhappy that no one can help me, said Lupa. She told the wolf all her troubles, beginning with the cow's death and ending with the spoiled tapestries. Never mind going to the market, said the wolf. Go home and don't worry. All will be well. With that, the wolf limped away on her bandaged leg and disappeared into the underbrush. Lupa was puzzled, but she reflected that the word of a she-wolf magical enough to talk was probably a word to be trusted. She buried the tapestries, not wanting her father to see them spoiled. Then she went home empty-handed. She told her father a white lie, saying that she had sold the tapestries and had been robbed on her way back home. Her father had worked all day and was hungry, but they had nothing to eat except for a few roots and seeds. They went to bed with rumbling stomachs and slept badly. Both Lupa and her father were sporadically awakened by the howling of wolves nearby in the forest. In the morning, Lupa felt too tired to get up, but she hurried out of bed when she heard her father shouting, "Look, look!" He was crying. Here on the doorstep, there lay a whole haunch of venison, freshly butchered, ragged at the edges as if it had been chewed from the carcass instead of cut. Father and daughter immediately roasted some slices for their breakfast and had their first good meal in a long time. The next day, they were startled to find a company of King's guardsmen on the same doorstep. The captain of the guards pounded on the door with his sword hilt and roared, "Open up in the king's name, poachers!" Lupa's father hastily opened the door. "I am no poacher, but a poor peasant," he said. "You have the wrong man. You've been poaching the king's deer in the royal woodland." "Don't deny it. We followed a blood trail right to your door." The guardsmen pushed their way into the hut and found the venison hanging by the hearth. The captain took one look and said, "You're both under arrest." In vain, Lupa and her father protested that the meat had been delivered to them by agents unknown, and they had no idea where it had come from. No one listened. They were seized, bound, and marched away to the king's castle to stand trial. After a miserable night in the dungeons, father and daughter were dragged to the audience chamber, where the king and queen sat surrounded by their courtiers. Even the twin infant princes were present. In their cradles, next to the queen's throne, an imposing official in a gold-trimmed black velvet robe announced the accusations against the various evildoers and presented the evidence. When it was his turn to respond to the charges against him, Lupa's father knelt before the king and pleaded innocent. He explained that a person or persons unknown had somehow left a haunch of venison on his doorstep during the night. The king seemed bored by this story. The defendant himself realized how feeble it sounded and lapsed into shamefaced silence. The queen, however, looked interested. She gazed intently at Lupa and her father. Lupa noticed that she had unusual yellowish eyes. "You will pass no sentence on these two," the queen said firmly. "I will make them my servants." "But my dear," said the king, "the penalty for poaching is execution." "I say these two will not be executed," said the queen, in a tone that brooked no opposition. "Guard, take them away to my quarters." Lupa and her father waited under a guard in the queen's drawing room until the queen appeared in person. She ordered their bonds removed and then dismissed the guardsmen. Lupa and her father fell at her feet and thanked her for her mercy. I am not merciful, only conscientious. I repay my debts. My former mode of recompense got you into trouble, and now it is up to me to repair the damage, she said. I don't understand, Your Majesty, Lupa said timidly. Does this look familiar? The queen asked. She rolled up her right sleeve. On her forearm was a bandage, slightly bloodstained. Lupa looked closely and recognized the strip torn from her own petticoat. Your Majesty is a she-wolf? Lupa was amazed. We will not speak of this again, said the queen. You, Lupa, will become my handmaid. Your father will be a royal gardener. He will be well paid and well fed, as will you also. Your life of starvation is over. Lupa and her father wept tears of joy and kissed the queen's hand. They never returned to their poor hut, but took up residence in the castle at once. Lupa served her royal mistress faithfully and well for many years. Her father tended the castle gardens with care and eventually rose to the rank of head groundskeeper. Lupa dug up the tapestries her mother had made, rinsed out their cheap dyes, and gave them the most expert of the royal needlewomen to be copied. The resulting work became known far and wide and celebrated as the Lupine Tapestries. Years afterwards, they were still prized gems in the National Museum. People said that sometimes, on moonless nights, Lupa and her father both underwent a strange transformation and ran through the forest with the wild wolves in a pack that was always led by a large gray female with yellow eyes and a scarred right foreleg. The end. And that was the story of the she-wolf. Now, you will hear the story of the white god. Once upon a time, the white god, Yawala, came to the African land and began causing great trouble among the animals. He allowed his followers to kill them in such numbers that for the first time in all the millennia, the animal nations grew smaller and smaller. The slaughter came to the attention of three goddesses, Oshun, Yemaya, and Mawu. They set out to investigate. They first questioned Elephant Mother, leader of the largest, oldest, and wisest nations among the warm bloods. She was in deep distress over the ongoing massacre of her people. The white god's men want only our big teeth, she complained. But they slay whole tribes to get them. They pile up mountains of my children's teeth to be exchanged for money. They are insane creatures. Oshun said, we've heard that Yawala insists on the superiority of killer males to nurturant females. What say you, Elephant Mother? Only another example of insanity, said Elephant Mother, waving her long, muscular trunk in disgust. Naturally, the life-giving sex is the only one important enough to need numerical upkeep. Most males are useless except for breeding, she said, and even then, they can be very clumsy and foolishly destructive during the mating. Our matrons are right to keep males out of the herds where young calves are being protected. Our bulls know their place. They're wise enough to remember their mother's teachings and stay away from the nursery herds. The goddesses went next to the Lion Mother, leader of the cat nations. She was constantly angry and growling over the destruction of cat people in general. They take our skins for no apparent reason, except to exchange them for money, she snarled. The mother of leopard, cheetah, and ocelot tribes have almost no children left. These men are homicidal maniacs, Yemaya said. We've learned that Yawala insists on the superiority of fighting males to hunting females. What say you, Mother Lion? The lioness gave a contemptuous snort. Males superior? She sneered. Another example of Yawala's insanity. Males, they don't do much but lie around in the shade, sleeping, or waste their time bullying cubs. Everyone knows that females raise every generation to maturity, bring home the meat, teach the children to hunt, and keep the murderous fathers away. Males are so indolent that they never lift a claw, if they can help it. They are the laziest creatures on the veldt. The goddesses went next to the Hyena Mother, leader of the Carrion Eaters. Hyena Mother was less tormented than the others because men didn't covet her people's skins, and hyenas had made a good living from the huge mounds of carrion that Yawala's men abandoned on the plains. She said, however, that they were obviously insane, for what sane creature would make a kill and then walk away from the meat? Furthermore, the killing had been so extensive that the herd supporting the hyena population had become quite thinned out. Mawu said, we've heard that Yawala insists on superiority of males to females. What say you, Hyena Mother? Hyena Mother laughed and laughed until all the hyenas in the world began laughing with her. That's the best joke I've heard in all my days, she gasped, wiping her eyes. Those little pipsqueak males superior. Everybody knows that females are bigger, stronger, faster, smarter, sexier, and better equipped to make a living than males are. It has to be so because we females bear the responsibility for birthing, nurturing, nourishing, raising, and training of every generation of our kind. No wonder Yawala's men kill for nonsensical reasons and leave the good parts behind. They're completely crazy. The goddesses went next to the Rhinoceros Mother and found her in a state of near collapse. So great was her sorrow over the decimation of her people. They are destroying all of my tribes for the most foolish reason in the world, she said mournfully. They have ancient, silly tales that equate one-horned mythical beast with sexual potency. Therefore, the white god's men eat rhino horn in the absurd belief that it will cure their impotence and all other weaknesses. They won't even go to the trouble of capturing my children, removing the horn and letting them go again. These men are lunatics, willing to kill and kill for their erroneous notions instead of learning the truth. The goddesses went next to Gorilla Mother and heard much the same story from her. She said, they kill and kill my people who only want to be left in peace, who cause no harm to any other creature, she said. I think the men must be insane enough to want to destroy themselves. There seems no other reason for their lunatic slaughter of the gorilla tribes, other than the fact that gorillas look something like them, so they may be killing one another in effigy. Of course, they also kill one another for real, an unthinkable act. In the view of my people, it's unthinkable. Obviously, they are out of their minds. The goddesses went next to Vulture Mother, leader of the great birds, widest winged and keen eye, among all her kind, she bobbed her bald, wrinkled head and cackled that the humans had once had the good sense to revere her 3,000 and more rainy seasons ago. They gave her the name of Nichimbet, they worshipped her as the symbol of every life's ending and rebirthing. "But I fear their males are born crazy from the egg," she said. "Perhaps the females also, to allow the males to neglect their primary duty, helping to nurture the young. Our bird brains are better than that." The goddesses consulted all other animal leaders they could find and heard the same thing over and over. The men of Yawala were crazy killers who didn't even wait for hunger, which was the only proper reason for killing. Even when fully fed, fat, and satisfied, they would go forth with terrible weapons and slaughter dozens of animals at a time and eat none of them. "The white god is insane," all the animals said. "The white god is insane, and he has corrupted his people. They no longer know how to behave in the world. They have become a pestilence." Oshun, Yemaya, and Mawu realized that something would have to be done. They thought the only logical choices for their agents on Earth were the human females, who must be encouraged to control their males, as did the females of other species. On further investigation, however, the goddesses found that many, if not all of the human females, were greatly weakened by Yawala's rules, which often mutilated their bodies, robbed them of their children, forced them into sexual slavery, and taught the men who should have been helping them to treat them instead with mindless hostility. "This Yawala is an abomination," said Mawu angrily. "He has even caused the women to forget us, their images, and preservers. The white god has got to go. Let us teach the women to despise him. Then," said Yemaya, "that's the first step. Show them that he has no spiritual power over them. Let them believe it thoroughly, and then they will regain temporal power. After all, nothing can change the fact that they are the mothers. Let the mothers accept only men who show decent, rational, fatherly behavior toward children and other living things," said Oshun. "Then the brutes who are not accepted may die out and their violent heritage with them. Will that be our plan, sisters?" The goddesses agreed and set to work to change the minds of women, one woman at a time. It was slow going. Most men opposed the goddesses in their mission, though a few of the more rational ones saw the sense of their arguments and began to help. Some of the men came to believe that it was wrong to hunt without hunger. Women learned to despise leopard skin coats and ivory ornaments, to reprimand others still ignorant enough to crave such things, and to laugh at men still ignorant enough to think rhino horns could cure their impotence. Women taught their children, and they taught their children, and they in turn taught their children. In time, the white god faded and became only one more minor consort of the powerful goddesses. Then Africa and its animal nations, the ones that managed to survive the great slaughters, began to flourish again. They lived a little more happily ever after because it was understood among them that the only killers were those who could digest vegetable food and who needed meat for their own hunger and that of their children. The goddesses watched the white god closely and made sure that he never seized the upper hand again. And that was the story of the white god. We now move on to A sweet little fairy tale. This version is called Snow Night. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful princess with skin white as snow and hair black as night. So she was called Snow Night. Her mother died when she was a baby, and her father remarried. Snow White's stepmother was a noted sorceress, and also famous for her beauty, of a more mature type than that of the young princess. Everyone at court watched with interest as Snow Night grew up to be a charming young woman. Particularly interested was her father's master of the hunt, who was called Lord Hunter. He aspired to improve his rank by marrying the royal princess. Moreover, he found Snow Night exceedingly desirable. Therefore, he made every effort to woo her. He sent her the best flowers plucked from the royal gardens and very bad poems plucked from his own mind. He subjected her to long monologues about his hunting successes. He hovered at her elbow in every procession and tried to fill her dance card with his own name at every grand ball. Snow Night, however, did her best to avoid him. Though he was arrogant and fancied himself a very gallant gentleman, she found his attentions unwelcome. His touch made her shudder. Lord Hunter was heavy, coarse, and greasy-haired. His breath stank, his fingernails were dirty, and his speech unrefined. Snow Night thought him repulsive. "If my father tries to make me marry a hideous old toad-like hunter," she said, "I will run away." Lord Hunter also tried to make himself agreeable to the queen, hoping to become her confidant. The queen called him her huntsman and tolerated him with good grace. She was amused by his constant flattery and diverted by his gossip. Before long, he came to think of himself as the queen's intimate friend, not knowing that she held a rather different view of the matter. One day, Lord Hunter found Snow Night alone in a remote part of the castle gardens, and he seized the moment. He swept off his hat, bowed, and knelt at her feet, bumping down rather heavily, holding up a long-stemmed rosebud as an offering. "Lovely princess," he said, hand on heart, "allow me to say what I've been yearning to say to you for a long time. You are the only woman I ever love. You are my beloved, the lady of my heart. Do say you will let me court you, and perhaps one happy day to marry you." "Marry," cried Snow Night, appalled. "I'm not ready to marry, but when I am, I will certainly marry a handsome prince, not an ugly old huntsman. Lord Hunter, you presume far above your station." Surprised in his turn by the vehemence of her rejection, Hunter snatched at her skirt with one hand, clamped her wrist together with the other. "You must not talk so to me," he exclaimed. "I'm a nobleman. Princess or not, you're only a young girl with little knowledge of the world. Maybe you should learn a lesson today." Angry and frightened by his boldness, she struggled to free herself. "How dare you lay your hands on me?" she demanded. "Let go at once." When he did not, she wrenched a hand free and struck his face, with her fingernails drawing blood. At this, Lord Hunter quite forgot himself. He wrestled her down to the ground and clawed at her clothes with some dim idea of ravishing her into submission. Snow White screamed and thrashed in panic, struck him with her fists, and finally kicked him in the crotch. As he curled up, gasping for breath, she sprang to her feet and spat at him. "Never, never come near me again. Do you hear me, you repellent monster?" Then she cried out, "I hate and despise you, and I always will." She ran away, leaving Lord Hunter feeling that his ambitions and other things were thoroughly ruined. Now Hunter's desire for the princess was replaced with hostility. He wanted to see her injured, even dead, in recompense for his humiliation. He sulked and brooded and awaited his chance. One evening he found the queen alone in her anteroom, consulting her magic mirror, which always told the truth. He sat quietly while she asked the mirror several questions. Then, as she was turning away, he said, "I wonder if your majesty has ever asked the mirror who is the fairest lady in the land?" The queen smiled. "I know the answer it would give, huntsman. Snow Knight is the fairest."
"Doesn't that anger you?" he said.
"No, why should it?" she said.
"Surely your majesty's great beauty has always been fairest in the land. Wouldn't that make the princess a usurper and an upstart?"
The queen laughed. "Well, we all go through our cycles, huntsman. The wise expect it. Younger life takes the place of the elder. It's the way of nature. Every mother of children feels it in her bones. To challenge nature is folly."
"But don't stepmothers always hate their stepdaughters?"
"That must be one of the ridiculous traditions about women invented by men. A stepmother has every reason to get along with her stepdaughter. Why cause unnecessary strife? In any case, I'm quite fond of Snow Knight. She's a good-hearted little thing. If a bit slow in her wit, why would I be so foolish as to mistreat her?"
"Your Majesty wouldn't undertake any such thing personally, of course," Hunter said, his obsession having deafened him to all her words, which he still believed were dissembling.
"According to an old story, the royal stepmother sends another to act for her, such as her faithful huntsman. He is the one charged with killing the stepdaughter and bringing back her heart in a jeweled casket." The queen gave him a shrewd glance. "You really are mad," she whispered. "Huntsman, that is an exceedingly obnoxious idea. Put it out of your head at once." But she saw from his slightly glazed look that the idea had already taken a firm hold on him. With a sudden chill, she realized that Snow Knight was in mortal danger. That night, the queen went to her tower room and worked a spell to call a clever raven to her window. When the bird appeared, she sensed it with an herbal smoke and said, "Fly to the land of the dwarves and tell the queen that I need 7 of her subjects, the ones most learned in techniques of concealment." The raven flew off. 3 days later, the queen put on a white wig, a long putty nose, a black cloak, and a black broad-brimmed crone's hat. Thus disguised, accompanied only by her personal maid, she went to the village inn to meet with the 7 little men from the land of the dwarves. They sat at a rough wooden table drinking flagons of ale. The queen produced a leather sack from the folds of her cloak and laid it before the leader, who opened it and poured forth a handful of glittering cut stones, sapphires, rubies, emeralds, and diamonds. The dwarves' eyes sparkled like the gems, which the dwarves love above everything else. "Magnificent," said the leader. "For this we will do anything you ask, short of killing ourselves." "I want you to watch the king's master of the hunt.
"Whose picture I show you here," said the queen. "I want you to also watch over the Princess Snow Knight without letting yourselves be seen. Here is her picture. If she leaves the castle, follow her. If the master of the hunt ever approaches her in such a manner as to do her harm, you are to seize and bind him, carry him back to Dwarfland, and keep him a perpetual prisoner. Your queen, who owes me a favor or two, will see to it." "We will obey in every particular," promised the leader of the dwarves. The queen arose and shook his hand. "Then it is agreed," she said. "From this moment on, let no one from the castle see you anywhere." She left the inn and returned by dark of night to her own quarters. Less than a week later, all the courtiers, except Lord Hunter, were gladdened by the news that a fine young prince named Charming was on his way from a neighboring country to woo Snow Knight in person. The king's huntsmaster kept to himself, avoiding his usual activities and his friends, who noticed that he was losing weight, seldom spoke, and never smiled anymore. Lord Hunter was obsessed by the demon of vengeance, which his violent nature could express only in violent terms. He never spoke to Snow Knight, but he watched her always, even going so far as to hide in a cupboard near her chambers for many hours during the night. On the day before Prince Charming was due, Snow Knight took her lapdog and her maid with a picnic basket out for a greenwood lunch. Lord Hunter seized the opportunity to follow them. No sooner had they settled in a pleasant glade when he sprang from the bushes, grabbed the princess, and trussed her like a chicken, ignoring her shrieks and struggles. Her little dog yapped and snapped at him and received a brutal kick that sent it flying against the tree. Her maid stood frozen with terror until Lord Hunter commanded her to lie down on her face. "No," screamed Snow Knight. "Don't stop. Run back to the castle and tell them. Run, you fool." But the maid was too long accustomed to habits of passivity and obedience. Her knees buckled, she sank down helplessly, and Lord Hunter trussed her too. Then he turned his attention to the squirming princess. He drew out his long hunting knife and advanced on her, madness gleaming in his eyes. Realizing that she was at the mercy of a murderer, she gave herself up for lost. Suddenly, the seven little men charged from all directions around the glade, disarmed Lord Hunter, and bore him to the ground. Six of them sat on him while the seventh untied the princess and her maid. They used the same ropes to bind up Lord Hunter even more tightly than a trussed chicken. The head dwarf then doffed his cap and bowed to Snow Knight. "This man will never bother your highness again," he said. "We are under orders to return with him to Dwarfland, where he will be imprisoned for the rest of his life." Ignoring Hunter's yells of protest, Snow Knight said, "Excellent. How can I repay you for saving my life?" "We have already been paid, your highness," said the dwarf, for dwarves are honest folk, "by your lady mother, the queen. With your permission, we will go now." The six dwarves hoisted the tight-wrapped body of Lord Hunter to their shoulders, for dwarves are strong folk, and marched away after their leader, singing lustily to drown out his snarls and curses. As their noise faded into the distance, Snow Knight and her maid collected their scattered picnic utensils and their wits. Snow Knight carefully carried her little dog, whose ribs had been broken, home to a bed in her dressing room where he could rest until he was healed. The next day, Prince Charming arrived on schedule, and he proved to be charming indeed. He and Snow Knight were delighted with each other. They soon became engaged, and within a year were married in a magnificent ceremony. The queen was matron of honor. Snow Knight never forgot her stepmother's wise forethought, which had saved her life. Both royal couples, elder and younger, lived happily ever after. As for Lord Hunter, his reason quite gone, he lived confined for the rest of his life as the dwarves' prisoner. In later years, he sometimes passed the weary hours by writing stories. It is said that he wrote an entirely different version of the story you have just heard. And that, my dears, is the story of Snow Knight. Now for a final story this evening. It is a story called Barbie Doll, or Barbie Doll, spelled B-A-R-B-I-D-O-L. Once upon a time, there was a toy shop where the dolls came to life at night, after dark. A half-forgotten genius named Mickey Mouse had taught them long ago to open the seals on their boxes and emerge for the nightly revels, then reseal themselves in at the first sight of dawn. Children sometimes noticed that the dolls bought in this shop looked a bit worn, but their elders seldom paid attention. Aside from the baby dolls, who did nothing but cry and wet and were excessively boring by far, the most popular doll in the shop was Barbie Doll, or known as Barbie Doll. She looked grown up enough to have lived about 18 human years, and she wore costumes enough to have lived about 18 human lifetimes. She was a fashion model, rock star, astronaut, cheerleader, nurse, beach bunny, princess, showgirl, artist, ballerina, actress, dream date, prom queen, gymnast, and beauty contest winner of at least 11 different nationalities. She had far more clothes than any other doll, and that put her at the top of the toy shop's social order. Barbie Doll had nothing but contempt for the human females, both large and small, who came to the shop. Not one of them had ever even approached her own perfect proportions. Their waists were too wide, their busts too small or droopy, and their feet were monstrously huge. Barbie Doll showed them the proportions they should desire but never achieve, so they could learn to despise their own appearance. She dreaded the day when some loudish adolescent would buy her and take her away from the shop where she was queen. Barbie Doll had several female associates whose proportions were exactly like hers, and also a male consort named Ken Doll. He looked a bit more like a human being in a prep school sort of way. Ken Doll's only mission in life was to escort Barbie Doll in her various roles and activities, so he was allowed to wear tuxedos, swimsuits, and ethnic or theatrical costumes, but no work clothes. He never worked. He looked down particularly on those humans who had to scrimp and save money that they earned by working in order to buy him. Like Barbie Doll, Ken Doll was a snob. One night, Barbie Doll noticed a new grown-up male doll on the premises. His name was G.I. Joe, and he wasn't interested in female dolls at all. He seemed to care only for uniforms, helmets, guns, grenades, bombs, and other battlefield hardware. He liked to kill enemies and blow things up. He knew nothing of proms, parties, fashions, cruises, or any of the other civilized frivolities that preoccupied Barbie doll and Ken doll. He dwelt only in the all-male, generally working-class milieu of war. Barbie doll found herself more and more fascinated by G.I. Joe, especially because he didn't seem affected by her charm. This was a novel experience for Barbie doll. She was used to being the center of attention at all times. She began to see G.I. Joe as a challenge to her powers of attraction. Besides, as she remarked to Ken doll, he was kind of cute. Ken doll didn't think so. He's shorter than you and built like an outhouse. Besides, he's not our sort. He probably doesn't even know how to dance. Wouldn't you be embarrassed if your friends saw you dating an ape like him? I don't think he's quite an ape, Barbie doll said meditatively. He's kind of sexy. Maybe with him I could do things I haven't done before. Maybe, but I'll bet you you wouldn't like them, Ken doll grumbled. He was feeling pangs of jealousy because he had never seen Barbie doll cast that speculative look upon anyone but him. G.I. Joe is nothing but a crude, low-class, stupid grunt without any breeding. I know. Trust me. Oh, I do trust you, Ken doll, she said, batting her eyelashes, which were real nylon and generally considered one of her best features. But it's always broadening to meet new kinds of people and have new kinds of experiences, don't you think? Yes, if you want to become nothing but a broad. Ken doll snapped at her irritably. He didn't often make puns because Barbie never caught on to them anyway, but he was fuming. Barbie doll ignored Ken doll's objections and began to flirt with G.I. Joe. Following her perennial guide, the How to Be Popular advice column for girls, she pretended to be intensely interested in whatever he liked. Consequently, she found herself listening to hours of his monologues about automatic weapons, handguns, assault rifles, ammunition, which he called ammo or rounds, explosive devices, minefields, barrages, air cover, foxholes, and beachheads. She was severely bored by all of this, but she liked watching G.I. Joe's eyes light up when he expounded on notable battles and famous generals. The fact that she couldn't understand what he could possibly think so fascinating about all these matters made him seem all the more exotic and unusual. She tried to attract G.I. Joe by becoming less frivolous. She neglected her customary activities. She didn't even talk about going to the mall. She lost interest in pool parties, luncheons, fashion shows, and shopping expeditions with her friends. She sometimes forgot to put on her makeup and style her hair properly. Her best friend, Midge, told everyone that Barbie doll was turning into a frump. The next thing you know, Midge said maliciously, she'll be spreading that hourglass waist into a jelly glass. Barbie doll's conversational skills deteriorated also. She was no longer able to discuss the latest designer jeans or this month's eyeshadow color, Tahitian apricot. Instead, she talked of airstrikes, tanks, and nukes. She let her clothes become shabby and unwashed. Her friends found her boring. Ken doll started dating Midge, though his heart wasn't in it. He missed the old Barbie doll and hoped to bring her to her senses by making her jealous. She didn't notice. G.I. Joe seemed to enjoy Barbie doll's rapt attention. However, on the few occasions when she did some of the talking, he would gaze into space, fiddle with his sidearm, or push his cap over his eyes and go to sleep. Barbie doll had an uneasy feeling that his interest in her talk was minimal at best. Still, she chattered on while his eyes glazed over or closed altogether. Piqued by his indifference, Trying to become more interesting, she began to do some unprecedented thinking. G.I. Joe talked so much about enemies that Barbie doll thought about them too. One day, in a fit of inspiration, she wrote a poem that she entitled, Against the Enemies. Triumphantly, she hurried to read it to G.I. Joe. Listen, she cried, against the enemies. They tell you to hate the devils who break, but when the war ends, they say, oh, now wait, we made a mistake. Those devils are friends. She sat back and waited modestly for his praise, but G.I. Joe only glared at her in silence that went on too long until Barbie doll began to feel uneasy. Don't you like it? She asked. It tells about enemies, see? It rhymes and everything. What kind of stupid cocky pock is that? G.I. Joe snarled. What are you, some kind of crazy pinko bleeding heart parlor liberal or something? Take your silly poem and get lost. Such unexpected rejection of her first literary inspiration infuriated Barbie doll, but she swallowed her anger and tried to smile, remembering the How to Be Popular advice column recommendation for getting a boyfriend to open up. She inquired about what the column called his personal life goal. What is your personal life goal? She asked. My what? You know, what you want to be, your ultimate ambition. Got no ambitions, said G.I. Joe. Take out the enemy, that's all. If you could be the kind of person you most admire, what would you be? A hero, I guess. Don't you want to be my hero? Barbie doll asked, fluttering her nylon eyelashes provocatively. G.I. Joe snickered. You don't hand out no medals, he said. You ain't nothing but a dumb broad. How dare you? Barbie doll cried. Her anger welled up, and she slapped his face as hard as she could. G.I. Joe grabbed her and shoved her up against the side of his box. Listen, doll, don't try to give me no hard time. I'm pretty sick of your airhead chatter. Broads like you should be seen and not heard. He shook her shoulders for emphasis. You're being totally nasty, Barbie doll exclaimed. You don't really like me at all. I like you all right, as long as you keep your mouth shut. You talk too much, and you don't know nothing important. Barbie doll burst into tears. Let go of me, you moron, she yelled. Why did I ever think you'd make a decent boyfriend? You're a bloody-minded pig with nothing between your ears but plastic explosives. At this, G.I. Joe slapped her face in return and pushed her away. Barbie doll ran off crying. It was the end of her flirtation with G.I. Joe. She never went near him again. She never again spoke of military matters. She returned to Ken Doll, declaring that he was the escort with whom she shared a true, profound philosophy. Ken Doll was glad to hear this, though he hadn't been aware that they shared any philosophy, profound or otherwise. One day, Barbie Doll asked him, Ken Doll, are you patriotic? Sure, why not? What's your patriotic personal life goal? What any patriotic guy wants, I guess. To have lots of friends, parties, a house with a swimming pool, a condo in the Bahamas, a widescreen TV, a wall-sized stereo, and three-car garage with a BMW, a Porsche, and a Ferrari. I can relate to that, said Barbie doll. Do you want to be a hero? No. Why not? Heroes are guys who get destroyed. Oh. Presently, G.I. Joe was sold to a small boy who liked to stage battles with real fire and serious mutilations. He tore off one of G.I. Joe's arms and stuck an ice pick through his body, interred him in a plastic body bag, and finally burned him severely in a fireworks explosion. G.I. Joe was forcibly retired, a wounded veteran, permanently scarred and half melted. He spent the rest of his days doing nothing at all in a dirty, jumbled, neglected toy box. Barbie doll and Ken doll were sold to a little girl who loved them, treated them well, and provided them with many new clothes, and they lived happily ever after. The end.
Polly wants a cracker. Think I should get off her first. Think she wants some water to put out the blowtorch. It's me, have a seat. Let me clip your dirty wings. Let me take a ride to put yourself. Want some help to help myself? I've got some rules you've been told. I promise you I've been true. Let me take a ride to hurt yourself. I want some help to help myself. Polly wants a cracker. Maybe she would like more food. She asked me to untie her. A chase would be nice for a few. Here's me, have a seat. Let me clip your dirty wings. Let me take a ride to put yourself. I want some help to help myself. I've got some rules you've been told. Promise you I've been true. Let me take a ride, don't hurt yourself. I want some help to help myself. Polly says her back hurts. She's just as bored as me. She caught me off my guard. Amazes me the will of instinct. It is me, have a seat. Let me clear dirty wings. Let me take a ride, don't hurt yourself. I want some help to help myself. I've got some rope you've been told. I promise you I've been true. Let me take a ride, don't hurt yourself. I want some help to fuck myself. Ha 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 ha.